Southwest winds between 10 and 15 miles per hour.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I come to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Militarism, brain-dead materialism, narcissism, many of the maladies people associate with our times. Our guest today will be talking about the roots of these problems, going back to the 1980s, an era when pop culture began the themes that dominate today. Our guest today will be David Sirota, author of the new book, Back to Our Future, one of the leading political commentators of our time. Should be a great hour. Hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
The combination of a bad economy and dramatic changes in the news audience and how they want their news delivered has led to a stark choice for the newspaper industry: adapt or die. In many instances, the innovators leading the process of adaptation are young journalists who see the opportunities that new technologies offer newsrooms willing to make changes. 29-year-old Jigsha Desai is one of those innovators. As visuals editor at the Knoxville News Sentinel in Tennessee, she made Editor and Publisher magazine's list of the 25 people under the age of 35 who are helping to reshape journalism and guide media companies through the digital era. She says the younger generation of journalists bring a different mindset to the newsroom, one that reflects the rapid 24-hour pace that readers have come to expect in a plugged-in world.
We are very non-traditional, that we don't think of it as there being one deadline, for instance, making sure, you have your story by 5 o'clock. We're always about instantaneous communication, making sure we're getting news on our phones. We're disrupting journalism as it is today.
Desai says she's constantly on the prowl for new tools that can help distribute media to better fit readers' changing needs. The Sentinel is using the website Storify to curate content for their website, and Ning.com for social networking. Desai says these creative ideas are generally met with appreciation among her coworkers who cut their teeth on traditional print journalism.
There are people who understand that this energy is needed to take journalism forward and to take the industry forward, and I think they recognize and appreciate this new energy that's coming in.
Among the ideas Desai is most excited about for the future of news is how mobile phones can use geolocation applications to tailor news for readers.
If you're in a neighborhood and you sign up to receive alerts from, say, the New York Times or whatever, and they know the news happening in Florence, Kansas, and they know you're there, they will probably send you an alert on your phone because of that. Instead of you having to find the news, your phone will know you're in Florence, Kansas, and be like, hey, since you're here, so just try this. So it's almost like a recommendation engine on your phone, depending on where you are.
To read the full list of journalism innovators under 35, visit editorandpublisher.com.
There are some technologies that society considers so important that it decides to make it available to everyone. From the interstate highways that connect the country to the Tennessee Valley Authority that brought electricity to vast reaches of the Southeast, as did the Hoover Dam in the Southwest, these projects are considered among the greatest accomplishments in American history. In 1996, the Federal Communications Commission brought the same commitment to telephone service with its Universal Service Fund. This small per-customer fee creates a pool of funds intended to provide every community with telecom services, especially rural and low-income communities, schools, libraries, and healthcare facilities at rates that are reasonably comparable to those charged in urban areas. Matt Wood is Associate Director of the Media Access Project. He's part of a broad movement to reform USF in order to support broadband build-out and adoption.
And our basic push has been to modernize and expand that program, which means improving the current structures, but also broadening it to include support for broadband deployment and adoption.
Amina Fazula, Policy Counsel for the Benton Foundation, explains why funding broadband adoption is so important.
When it comes to adoption of broadband in low-income communities, there are a number of hurdles that folks have identified in various studies. And so, there's obviously cost, but there's also purchasing the equipment as well as the ongoing monthly subscription fee. And then beyond that, there's understanding how to use the equipment, upkeep of the equipment, software update. And then beyond that, just really understanding what the internet has to offer.
Online access is not a luxury in many parts of the country, says Ejayel Casa Peralta, coordinator of the Rural Broadband Policy Group. She believes reliable, affordable, high-speed internet is a vital link to economic and social participation.
In a lot of rural communities, we lack a lot of basic infrastructure, right? Our schools are consolidating or shutting down, post offices, libraries are closing down. There's not a lot of hospitals around or higher ed facilities or even banking institutions. And so the internet is really an access portal for us to be able to access everyday services. And so as everyday services go online more frequently or are transported to the online world, then these funds play a really vital role in continuing to provide access to healthcare, education, political participation, and democracy for our community.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, May 8th, 2011, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is someone who's been on the show before, who's one of the leading political commentators, columnist, radio talk show host in the nation, someone I've known for many years, going back to his career in Washington, D.C., working on the staff of then Congressman Bernie Sanders, now Senator Bernie Sanders. David Schroeder, our guest, is also the author of a brand new book, Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explained the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. We're going to be talking about the book and politics, of course, here today for the full hour. David Schroeder, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you. And you're in Denver today, I assume, your home base?
I am.
And as I got a notification, you are a talk show host of a daily show in Denver, and it's one of the top-rated shows in the market. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's had some really, really big ratings growth over the last year, in part because we do a lot of things differently than other talk shows, I think, or at least I'd like to tell myself that.
Well, what are they? Yeah, maybe I'll give me some tips.
Well, we try to keep things we try to mix in local, and we try to not simply carry the water for either political party. It's not about red versus blue. And the other thing we do is that we don't just cover, like your show doesn't, we don't just cover straight up Washington politics only. There's a whole world of news happening out there that's really important and is often completely left behind by traditional media, and there's a huge demand for it. At least that's what the ratings tell me out here.
Well, that's very exciting, David Sirota. And we go back, as I said in the introduction, a long way. You started your career working in Washington as a lobbyist, or not as a staff member, but even a lobbyist, if I'm not mistaken. Well, give a little bit of your background, if you would.
Yeah, I started in Washington working for Bernie Sanders as a staffer. I was his press person, and then I went to go work as the third staffer for the Center for American Progress. From there, I went to go work for Brian Schweitzer, who was running for, first he ran for Senate in Montana, then he ran for governor, and he became the governor. My wife and I moved out to Montana to, she worked with him in his administration, and then we moved down to Denver, and I got a job doing a radio show.
Well, and then you've all brought to the present where you've got this brand new book out published by Ballantine Books, Back to Our Future, about the 1980s. And I mentioned this book to a friend of mine, a very good friend, and their instant response was sort of a grimace to say, of all the decades I'm trying to forget, the 1980s is number one on the list. And so why the 1980s? Why did you write this book? What was the thinking behind it?
Well, I noticed a lot of similarities in what was being said in the stories of not just the political rhetoric between the 1980s and today, but a lot of similarities between the political rhetoric and the assumptions that are made in the media and the storylines of 1980s pop culture. So movies, TV, video games, toys, and the like. And I'm a child of the 80s, and so I started exploring, well, why are there these similarities? Why do we talk about so many major issues today in the vernacular of 1980s popular culture? Again, movies, TV, video games, and the like. And I started exploring that, and I also started asking the question, does it have something to do with the fact that 1980s cultural products have been making a big comeback, that it seems like every movie is a remake of a 1980s movie? It seems like 1980s music is back. It seems like everybody has nostalgia for the 80s, and certainly that's part of that is just straight-up nostalgia. But another part of it, I argue in the book, is that it has been brought back because it's the language that we still speak as a country today, a language that we started speaking in the 1980s and a language that we haven't stopped speaking, and that's a huge problem. And I break the book down into a couple of different ways, broad themes about that. I mean, I still think we're, and we can get into this, I still think we're speaking in the 80s language of militarism. We're still speaking in the 80s language of the individual over the common good. We're still speaking in the 80s language of greed is good. We're still speaking in the 80s language of race and the idea that race is something to be downplayed and to pretend that there isn't racism in our country. And then finally, I argue that even the contours of our politics right now, in the sense of what always dominates our campaigns, even that is straight out of the 1980s. Specifically, it always seems like every election now is an epic battle between an image of the 1950s and an image of the 1960s, not the actual 1950s or 1960s, but an 80s distorted image of the 50s as this great thing and the 60s as this horrible thing.
Yeah, and David Sorta, let's talk about that, because I think that one of the really interesting discussions in the book is how the 1960s has been sort of reinterpreted and recast and reframed by popular culture in the 1980s. It really went to work to change our understanding of the 1960s. And discuss a little bit about your assessment of the 60s and how pop culture in the 80s changed it and how that affects our understanding of the 60s today.
Yeah, well, I mean, it starts really, you have to start with the fact that Ronald Reagan was a guy who defined the 1980s, and in the 1960s himself was a guy who defined himself as against the 1960s or against what was going on in the 1960s. This is a guy who became governor of California by railing on protesters at Berkeley. So coming into the 1980s, he was a guy whose entire political and rhetorical argument was based in revivalism, going back to before what he called the evil 1960s. I'm obviously paraphrasing, but this was his whole thing: restoring the country from, and I put that in quotes, restoring the country from what happened in the 1960s. And this is echoed in all sorts of the cultural products of the 1980s as Reagan is making this case. And of course, Reagan is making this case through the prism of issues as wide as affirmative action and busing and the backlash to the civil rights and states' rights. So he is making this argument on specific issues, and the popular culture of the 1980s is making a larger argument about this as well. And let me give you some examples, and these are just examples, and there's 10 others. But you know, the one of the most popular shows in the 1980s was Family Ties. And Family Ties, if you look at the show, Family Ties is a show about an aspiring yuppie who is, and the comedy pivots off of him basically making fun of his parents' 60s idealism. I mean, and you know, it's good fun, and look, I'm a fan of Family Ties, but that's the fulcrum of so much of the situation in that situation comedy. You look at the movie The Big Chill, which was a hugely popular, iconic movie of the 1980s.
And that's from 1982, if I'm not mistaken.
It's 82 or 83.
Yeah.
And the thing is, if you think about, when you listen to that story, and you listen to what the characters are saying, every character in that movie is absolving him or herself for discarding their 60s idealism and quote-unquote getting real about their lives in the 1980s. And some of the characters are harsh about the 60s. Other characters are not that harsh. But the overarching point is that it was a good idea to get away from the ethos of the 60s, because the ethos of the 60s was anywhere from in kind of silly and stupid to downright evil. And this is a theme that comes out of the 1980s that then, of course, comes to dominate our politics. This is why every presidential election, the Republicans are trying to tie the Democrats to this 1980s idea of the 1960s. I mean, they reached as far in the last election. It was insane. They tried to take a guy who was barely alive in the 1960s, Barack Obama, and desperately try to tie him to the 1960s via Bill Ayers. I mean, it was desperate, but in its desperation, it showed just how much this idea of the 1960s, this 1980s created idea of the 1960s, still sticks with us.
No, and I read the book. The one thing that I thought was missing in your discussion, which was great, about the 80s treatment of the 60s, David Sirota, was how it sort of culminated in the novel Forrest Gump that became the film in the 1990s, where the 1960s, the radicals and the students of the period are presented as just, almost in sort of, if had it been about African Americans, it would be considered sort of, charlatans of blackface or something. Mm-hmm. It was just amazingly.
Yeah, and Forrest Gump is, as you mentioned, a product of the 90s. But what I would say to that is, you're absolutely right, that what I'm arguing here is that the 1980s never really stopped in the way that we shape storylines, the stories that we tell ourselves. Forrest Gump is basically, you're exactly right, an extrapolation of all of this about the 1960s, an extrapolation of this in the 1990s. It helped continue those storylines. And similarly, this is really what it's about. It's not just the 60s. It's pitting the 1950s against the 60s. That this idea that if we just go back to the 1950s when things were better, it's a selective storyline, right?
And as you point out in the book, I mean, this notion of the 1950s is every bit as artificial as the notion of the 1960s, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the 1950s through the prism of the 1980s became a time of supposed national unity, a supposed time of completely broad prosperity. Certainly prosperity was more shared, at least among white people, than it was today. But written out of the story was, lynch mobs and Jim Crow laws and religious bigotry and inequality for women. Also, interestingly, conveniently written out of the story has been a 90% top tax rate in the 1950s.
As well as labor union participation of a third of the workforce.
Exactly. And this is written out of the story, again, both through the rhetoric of Ronald Reagan and through cultural products. I mean, just think of the movie Back to the Future. Back to the Future, basically Marty McFly flees the chaos of modernity into a supposedly idyllic a place called the 1950s, where the biggest problem, the only real problem in society, is a big bully named Biff, right? So this creates this idea that we now hear from Tea Party folks all the time saying things were better back in the 1950s. We just have to go back to the 1950s. They're not really saying, well, let me put it this way. I think most of them are not really saying, let's go back to the real 1950s. They're saying, let's go back to the 1980s idea of the 1950s. I mean, I do think some of them are actually saying, frankly, let's actually go back to the 1950s, where, for instance, white people were a much more privileged class than they are today. But I do think that a lot of it, just reflexively, is not even a thinking about that. It's simply, I have this image embedded in my mind about what the 50s were from the 1980s, and that's the ideal we should aspire to.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is David Sirota, author of the new book, Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explained the World We Live in Now, Our Culture, Our Politics, Our Everything. David Strode is a newspaper columnist. He hosts a radio show in Denver. I think he's well known to people who follow politics in the United States. He's all over the cable news shows as a guest periodically, and he writes for the Huffington Post. It's a pleasure and honor to have him back on the show today. If you want to call in with a question or comment for David Strode, either about his book on the 80s or just about politics today, the number here at WILL is 333-9455. That's area code 217-333-9455. Or our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. And the phone lines are open. You know, one of the things I really liked about the book, David, was you had a great discussion, a long discussion, really, of this whole notion of narcissism, which I think you correctly identify as sort of a national crisis in this country today, especially among young people, and how much the culture of the 1980s really hyped sort of a narcissistic personality. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that it's kind of a related to the idea of both the deification of the individual in the 1980s and the glorification of wealth, of huge amounts of wealth. And I call the section in the book on this, I call it the Jumpman Chronicles. The Jumpman, of course, is that silhouette of Michael Jordan jumping over, that red silhouette jumping over everybody, the individual as more important than the team. And that was really embodied so much in the branding of Michael Jordan and really in the branding of Nike, and how Nike sold heroes. They called themselves, they were in the hero business. And Nike was, of course, I would say, in the top 10, if not the number one most powerful branding operation in the 1980s and beyond. And if you think about what, and this is just one example, but what they were selling, what their motto was, it was just do it. Every individual can achieve a Michael Jordan-like fate if you simply will yourself to fly over your team individually. So there was a big focus in the 1980s on the individual. Of course, Ronald Reagan was always talking about the individual and how much more important the individual was than quote-unquote collectivism. And this melded with the accumulation of huge amounts of wealth in the 1980s, inequality became a bigger and bigger part of our nation's economy. And though most people weren't doing better in the 1980s economically, a few people were doing stupendously better, and they became heroized on the covers of magazines and the like. I mean, this is the era of the CEO savior, the Lee Iacocca's, who could save the world. Ronald Reagan himself became a larger-than-life president. I mean, the 1980s was the time of really, truly larger-than-life individuals who were sold to us as saving our world. And one of the ways they would save our world is to become very, very, very wealthy. Well, you put all this together, and you put it into a increasingly media-immersed society. The roots of reality TV, for instance, started in the 1980s. And what you really were telling people was, ignore the common good, ignore everything else but yourself. Basically, it is the idea that we don't tolerate greed. Greed isn't something that's just there. Greed for yourself individually is the good, is the thing that we hold up as the value in society. And if you look at the data, the empirical social survey data from the 1980s, we see how this changed things. I'll give you one data point. It's just an example. My book has a bunch of them.
Yeah, and it's really, if I can just interject before you get to the data, that's why I really got to this, because the data is mind-boggling. It's jaw-dropping.
It's really incredible. I mean, when you ask people, I found this to be one of the most incredible stats, was that when you look at the year-to-year survey of college freshmen and you ask them, what are your goals? Why are you going to college? In the beginning of the 1980s, the biggest goal was to achieve a meaningful philosophy of life. By the end of the 1980s, that had completely plummeted as a priority among college freshmen, and the top goal by far was to make more money. And those numbers have remained that way since the 1980s. So we have to ask ourselves, okay, well, if before the 1980s, that wasn't the case. And then after the 1980s, that was the case. We have to ask ourselves what happened in the 1980s to make that change.
And the other thing that I thought of when I read this discussion of narcissism, David Sirota, was the survey research shows, along with this increase of wanting to make money, and another survey you quote identifies as sort of in the narcissism index, young people are much higher today than they were in the 70s, but is that the decline of empathy that goes with that towards other people. And that's one of the striking features in surveys of young people over the last three or four decades, is the sharp drop in sort of empathetic concern for the fate of other humans.
Yeah, I think again, I go back to the idea of greed is good, because what that really is saying, I mean, it's the Randian idea that it's not that you're committing a sin or committing an act of immorality by not thinking about your fellow human. The idea in the 80s that had, and look, it had always been around, but the idea that went mainstream in the 1980s was that the best way for you to serve society, to serve the greater good, is to serve only yourself. And again, this goes back to, this is the philosophy, of course, of Ayn Rand, but it didn't, as we see in the data about this, about the rise in narcissistic personality disorder, in the rise of the narcissism index, in the rise of what people say their big goals are in life, this didn't become the major mainstream objective in society until the 1980s.
Ayn Rand was an explicit atheist, and she made no bones about that in her work. But, a lot of the people since the 1980s who've been promoting the sort of policies and worldview you just outlined are also serious, religious devotees, or, they make themselves clear that they have a strong faith and they're faith-centered. How does religion reconcile itself to this sort of narcissism?
I think that's a profound question. I'm not exactly sure. What I can say is that some of it, I think, is justified through the idea of the work ethic. It's that old Calvinist idea that everybody needs to work really hard individually and be industrious. I do think, though, that you're right, that there is a fundamental conflict, and I think what you're speaking to is not just from the 1980s. It's since the what some people have called the unholy alliance is since the 1980s of religious cultural conservatives and economic conservatives under the umbrella of the Republican Party, that these are questions that increasingly, I think, are going to be fissures in the Republican Party. I mean, you've seen a little bit of it in the last Republican primary in 2008. Mike Huckabee, a very conservative, cultural conservative candidate, was also echoing some economic rhetoric that was as populist as John Edwards was echoing on the Democratic side in that primary. I think that ultimately your question is going to be a question that if the Republican Party today doesn't reconcile itself to, I think there's going to be a major fissure.
Our guest today, David Sirota, author of the new book, Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live in Now. Our culture, our politics, our everything, just published by Ballantine Books. It's great to have him here live on the program. The telephone number, if you want to call in with a question or comment, is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our first caller, who's been waiting patiently. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Yeah, getting more topics as I listen, too. I was prompted to call because it seems to me that I would like for the author, David, to suggest a mechanism for this zeitgeist cultural hegemony. I'm thinking of the blue line that J. Edgar Hoover had. He explicitly had I think it was G-Man, the radio show, but then the FBI, the TV show, the producers sent him a copy of the script. And if he saw something in it that didn't represent the FBI the way he liked it, he would blue line it, and they would offer him an alternative. So it's getting up there with having this producer of 24 being a bosom buddy of Cheney, I guess, and and that sort of thing.
Well, it's actually, I mean, it's actually from the 1980s. It's actually more direct even than the Cheney 24 connection. It goes back to the idea that you suggested with J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, and before I get to what I want to get to on that, I want to say this, because I want to be very clear. I am not arguing that the cultural products of the 1980s as a whole were some sort of conspiracy among cultural producers to sell America on conservative or right-wing memes and storylines. What I argue in the book, and it goes to the question that people ask me all the time, well, did Ronald Reagan create the 80s or did the 80s create Ronald Reagan? Did Hollywood create the conservatism of the 1980s or vice versa? My take on that question is that for the most part, that the creators of cultural content outside of the political arena were only trying to get people to buy tickets, to get people in front of television screens, to get people to buy toys and video games. So my point in saying that is that there was not as much a conspiracy. There was simply that the 1980s cultural products were reflecting what these cultural producers thought was the easiest shorthand to communicate with the electorate, the public at the time. So what we really have, I think, when you look back at 1980s cultural products, is a record of what that language was. Now, I'm not saying that it didn't go both ways, but what I'm saying is that I don't want to come off as saying I think, you know, a bunch of people in Hollywood got together to sell America in some sort of coordinated conspiracy. I think that what they were trying to do was say, all right, listen, what is the country thinking and saying right now, and how do we shape products that reinforce that because it's the lowest common denominator. Now,
and David, just to clarify this, because in your book, the sense I get is the media plays a large role as the sort of powerful propaganda machine, whatever their structural reasons they do it or intent, it does have the effect of really being the propagator of these values.
100%, that's right. I just want to be clear that it would be actually an easier thing to deal with if I could point to you, hey, there's a real conspiracy here, and it's controlled by 20 people who deliberately did this, and all we got to do is change the 20 people. You're exactly right. This is a propaganda machine. The media played and continues to play a huge role in selling us on 80s storylines, but the problem is that it's so diffuse that it almost seems invisible. It's not just 20 people. Now, all of that said, to get to one of your caller's points, which I think is really important, all of that said, there are a couple of ways that there really is what you can, I think, call a true conspiracy going on in certain specific areas. And what I want to key in on is the issue of selling us on the specific issue of militarism. Right. And this is a part of my book that I found when I was researching it. It really kind of blew my mind.
It blew mine as I read it, too. And I'm glad you're getting to it now because I wanted to later.
Right now, and really it intensified in a very deep way in the 1980s, the Pentagon works directly with Hollywood on movies about war and peace. And here's how it works. And to be clear, this has been going on in some way, shape, or form since the 1930s. Wings, the first Academy Award-winning movie, had Hollywood studios coordinating with the Pentagon. But it didn't get as intense and as prevalent until the 1980s. Now it's everywhere. And what happens is this. Basically, Hollywood wants to write a movie, or wants to produce a movie about something dealing with the military. Hollywood goes to the military, the film office, and says, we'd like to make this movie. And the film office says, well, great, we'd like to help you make this movie. We'll give you cheap access, free access in some cases, to all sorts of military hardware that you, the studio, if you had to go out and get on your own, it would cost you millions, tens of millions of dollars. And the Pentagon says, we'll give you access to all of this as long as we can see your script and line edit your script for content, specifically for content to make sure that the military and militarism is portrayed favorably. Now, this is what's crazy about this is wide out in the open if you simply look into it. I mean, the Pentagon is very forthright about this. And I quote in my book Pentagon officials quite openly saying that, look, it's our goal, our job, we're employed to make the Pentagon look good. And if a studio comes to us and they want to make a movie that's critical, even by the way, factually critical of the military, we're not going to help them. We're not going to give them access to taxpayer-owned hardware for the purposes of filming the movie. Now, what this has done, of course, this is effectively a huge taxpayer subsidy specifically targeted at making pro-war, pro-military, pro-militarist movies. And what it does, and I quote a studio executive in the book, a studio executive telling Variety magazine, telling them, listen, what this has done is basically what we do now is, as studios, we tell screenwriters as they're writing their screenplays, if you cannot get the acceptance of the military for your script, then don't bother writing your script because we will not make the movie. And it's just a business decision at the studio level because what they're really saying is the subsidy from the Pentagon is so huge, is so profitable, is so integral to making a movie on the cheap that we're not going to make any movie that doesn't have that acceptance. And so this is why for every anti-war or anti-militarist movie that somehow gets made, you have 10, 20, 30, 40 pro-war, pro-militarist movies in the theaters.
David Schroeder, do you have any idea what the cash size on an annual basis of this Pentagon program or subsidy is? I mean, how much are taxpayers forking out to subsidize pro-war films?
I can't put a number on it because it is so ubiquitous. And it's so fungible. So here I'll give you an example. In Top Gun, the movie that really started intensifying this, and by the way, the military at theaters put out recruitment tables outside of theaters that were showing Top Gun. This is where it really got into gear. Top Gun, the total cost to the studio of using the planes in that movie was about $1.2 million total. Now, that's a movie all about planes, right? It's got all sorts of footage of landing on the aircraft carrier. I mean, you're talking about fuel being used. You're talking about, scores, if not hundreds of military soldiers being used on the flight deck to fly these planes to service them, et cetera, et cetera. So the studio only had to shell out $1 million. So I can't give you a number in the sense of, and because there wasn't an accounting of it, of how much the military spent to give away all of the resources on top of the $1 million that the studio fronted, but it's a lot. And here's the crazy part. That's just one movie. That's one movie, right? So every time, and the key thing is for listeners to think about is, it's not just movies about war, right? It's any time you see the military in a movie tangentially. I mean, think about the movie. One movie that gets a lot of military coordination, a.k.a. subsidy, is the Transformers series. The military is portrayed as the central hero in the movie. That's what the Pentagon wants. That's why you're starting to see recruitment ads at the beginning of movies right now. It's because there really is a tight relationship between the Pentagon and Hollywood. And if I can, just for another 30
sure.
seconds, this brings up a major, major First Amendment issue. The First Amendment issue is this. And ultimately, I think that this could be, at some point in the future, some sort of Supreme Court issue, because it really is in a gray area. Is the government preferencing a certain form of speech and effectively abridging another form of speech? If you listen to studio executives who are making these movies, they will tell you, they're effectively saying yes, that the government subsidy is preferencing pro-war, pro-military speech and creating an economic disincentive to effectively make it almost impossible to make anti-militarist movies frequently.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, David Sirota, the newspaper columnist, radio talk show host, political commentator, and author of the brand new book, Back to Our Future, How the 1980s Explain the World We Live In, our culture, our politics, our everything, just published by Ballantine Books. We've got David Sertl live on the phone lines with us from Denver, Colorado. The telephone number here at WILL, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment, is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's see where we are. I think we've got a caller, line two, Urbana. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Sirota.
How about the theory that communism kept the community spirit in the United States alive by fear, and also sort of kept the lid on all of these outrageous CEO remunerations, and when communism fell, everybody who was greedy came out of the woodwork and took over the media. I'll take the answer off the air.
Well, thank you very much, caller. So, David Sirota?
Well, what I would say is that I take a longer view of it than just communism, although obviously the communism is something to, as the boogeyman, was around for a long time. What I would say is that it's certainly true that the 1980s was a time was the last gasp of using communism as the boogeyman to subvert other questions and suppress other questions about our own government. I mean, and of course, what's replaced that now has been the war on terrorism, the so-called war on terrorism. And so I think that it was the last gasp. I think it was a gasp that was fueled by Ronald Reagan, obviously fueled by all sorts of movies and TV shows about the Red Menace. But what I would say is this, is that what was fascinating to me in researching the book was how deftly we switched over to the so-called war on terrorism as the new boogeyman. How smooth a process that was in the 1980s, and I'll give you two examples of this. G.I. Joe, the television toy line, the comic book, the TV show, G.I. Joe had gone out of existence in the mid-1970s during the Vietnam War. It had been a toy around for a long time. And it was resurrected in the early 1980s as basically a terrorist fighting force. And in interviews with the creators of G.I. Joe, they said, listen, we basically foresaw that the Soviet Union was going to collapse and that we needed a new never-ending menace to organize the mind of children around. And so we created a stateless terrorist organization called Cobra. Now, similarly, what you saw in professional wrestling, as another example, you had the good guys and the bad guys. And for a while in the early 1980s, the bad guys were a bunch of people, caricatures from the Eastern Bloc countries. But towards the end of the 1980s, that was replaced by a guy called the Iron Sheik. And so I hold up these two examples as just two examples of a larger trend of how the 1980s, the cultural products of the 1980s, were a step ahead even of the political rhetoric of the 1980s in helping to create the new boogeyman that then, of course, our society is now organized around fighting.
Well, David Sirota, in the book, you spend a lot of time talking about how the 1980s pop culture and sort of main themes that live with us today, certainly. One of the big ones you talk about, too, is the demonization of government as evil, except for military, which is great, and sort of this sort of, you know, dual treatment of government.
Yeah, and this is one of the really big pieces of cognitive dissonance that comes out of the 1980s. At the very moment that we are being told in all sorts of ways that the government is evil, from Ronald Reagan saying, you know, the scariest words, I'm from the government, I'm here to help, from Ronald Reagan saying that kind of thing to the cop movies and the cop TV shows basically showing that the biggest impediment to justice is the government or the bureaucracy. As all of that is being taught to us, also at the same time, we're being told to never, ever question the military, that big government, huge government, is not just okay but laudable if that part of huge government is the military. And this, of course, continues today. Whenever people rail on big government, they're not talking about, typically, the military. We're talking about social programs. We're talking about criminal justice programs and the like.
You talk in the book, if I can interrupt you, David, in the book you have a great discussion of a city near you, Colorado Springs, Colorado, is sort of the epitomization of this whole dichotomy.
Absolutely. Colorado Springs, for those who don't know it, Colorado Springs is one of the most Republican cities, Republican communities in the country. And interestingly, I just noticed this. Just to tell you how Republican this is, there's the Interstate 25. As you go south from Denver on Interstate 25, the name, once you hit El Paso County, which is Colorado Springs' county, the name of the highway becomes Ronald Reagan Highway. When it leaves El Paso County, it goes back to its regular name, which is John F. Kennedy Highway. So this is a Republican bastion. But here's the crazy part about it. This is a super Republican bastion where one-third of its entire economy, one-third, one in three jobs are connected to the government through the military because it has all sorts of military bases around it. And so Colorado Springs is the perfect epitome of what came out of the 1980s. Military government is excellent. Any kind of other government is terrible. Now, what's really interesting, of course, is, well, then, how did the 1980s teach us to think about the things that the government does inevitably and inarguably well, right? How does the government how did the 1980s and Ronald Reagan and the like explain the government catching criminals, the government doing all, you know, fighting for justice, the things that indisputably the government does well? And out of this, I think, in the 1980s comes the idea of the rogue. The only people in government we can count on are those who are inside the government breaking laws, the individuals inside the government who are willing to go rogue inside the government. Now, a good example of this, although there was a whole genre of movies like this in the 1980s, was Die Hard, right? Die Hard, a government employee, John McClane, the police officer, has to go rogue against his own police department to fend off a major terrorist attack on Los Angeles. Now, obviously, this whole idea stays with us today because every political campaign, each candidate is inevitably promising that once they get inside the government, they're going to go rogue. But it's not just the political campaigns where this impacts, right? The idea of the rogue inside the government going rogue against the laws of the land, you saw this in policymaking. You saw it from Oliver North. This was his entire argument during the Iran-Contra hearings, that he had to go rogue to protect the country. This is what you heard basically from George Bush and the media when discussing warrantless wiretapping or torture, that it was necessary for him to protect the nation, to go rogue from within the government. And the problem with this, I would argue, is that what this has taught us to do is say that is the opposite of John Adams' idea that we're a nation of laws, not men. It's basically taught us to not trust social institutions, that you can never trust any enduring social institutions. The only thing you can trust, if anything, are the single individuals who will break apart those institutions.
Our guest, David Sirota, the phone number here, 333-9455. Toll free 1-800-222-9455. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, May 8th, 2011. Let's go back to the phone lines now to our toll free line. Line 4, New York, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, I'd like to say that even though I'm in New York, I actually listen to David's radio show every day. I download it and find it terrific. So
thank you.
I really appreciate it. And I also like to say, you know, ironically, there's a promo on MSNBC where Rachel Maddow points out that she's talking about a story that literally no one else is talking about. And, you know, to sort of echo something that Jeff Cohen said last week, I think that probably there's almost nothing on NBC that someone else isn't talking about. And I think that you, David, actually do provide something of a difference in that respect. Just to briefly touch on the point about militarism, there's a really great documentary that was produced by the Media Education Foundation called Real Bad Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
It actually looks at the issue of, you know, the portrayal of Arabs. And there's a huge amount of it that certainly very much focuses on the military aspect of it, and specifically, you know, a film that, that now Senator Jim Webb actually produced and wrote called Rules of Engagement. So I don't know if you ever have seen that, but it's got a lot of great stuff in it. But the thing I wanted to talk about mostly is the sort of issue of socioeconomics and how that's played out on TV. And like you were saying, what has happened in the 80s, you think back to the 70s, you had shows like, you know, Good Times or One Day at a Time or even Alice, where you had like working class people, even poor people, represented on television. And then in the 80s, you just saw that sort of systematically scrubbed and replaced with, you know, The Cosby Show. And, you know, the other thing that sort of happened at that time, and people sometimes don't remember, is that The Cosby Show, every week, you know, being the top-rated show in America, had an audience on a percentage basis the size of roughly what the Super Bowl gets now. And that since then, moving into the 90s, what started to happen was that the most popular television shows between a black audience and a white audience actually completely diverged. And so even though you saw Seinfeld and Cheers and all these shows that were at the top moving into the 90s, Friends, for example, is the number one, black people, and I say that only because Nielsen would measure it that way, I consider it sort of a proxy of a lower socioeconomic class, that basically, you know, the television producers stopped caring about those people. And then, you know, my final point I would say is that, Dave, you did this sort of game where you talked about reality shows and tried to stump people as to whether one was real and one wasn't. And actually, I found it personally really easy because all you had to do was think about whether, you know, the concept of the show somehow shone a light on poor people versus rich people, or whether it, you know, took poor people and put them in, you know, a real world type scenario where they lived like rich people. And pretty much now it feels as if the entire media landscape has just decided to, you know, ignore a certain class of society. And that is ultimately the narcissism that we see, is that it's really narcissism of only one unique perspective.
Let me respond, because you've thrown a lot out there.
Thank you, caller, for calling, first of all.
Okay,
David?
And I appreciate you listening to my show. The compliments, I really, really appreciate it. The issue, I think, is easiest to see in the 1980s, as you allude to, through the issue of race. And race naturally in America has intersected with economics. And what I do in the book is I take a look at the arc of how race is portrayed on television from the 1960s all the way through to the 1980s and then beyond. And what you see is that, and you can even just look at it through the story of Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby in 1960 was on I Spy, a show whose producers basically, and he was the first lead actor in a show, African American actor in a major primetime show, and who wasn't basically a minstrel character. He was a serious character. He was the smart guy among the duo. It was considered groundbreaking, and the show basically said, the producers of the show basically said, we're not going to talk about race at all. We're basically, you're going to be an African American character, but we're never going to acknowledge that you're an African American character openly. It'll just be we'll be saying what we want to say by simply having you on the show. And what comes out of that from the 1960s, then we move into the era of the Norman Lear shows, which show a lot of working class African Americans. It had been criticized in some parts for minstrelizing those characters, but a lot of the critical acclaim said that this is the first time that working class African Americans had been humanized to the white audience. Out of that, in the late 1970s and into the very early 1980s, you get a more aspirational a genre of African American characters like Benson, Family Ties, like the Jeffersons moving on up, where they're not working class characters, they are more upper middle class characters, and then this ends up at the Cosby Show, as you allude to, which is showing a very wealthy family, a very wealthy African American family. And as this is happening, and this is important, as this is happening, the rhetoric in politics and in the culture is that racism is over. We don't need to deal with racism anymore because the civil rights movement got America past racism. We've solved racism. And so the change in television tracked this, I think, false concept in our political realm that said we had gotten beyond racism. And there was a lot of criticism of The Cosby Show at the time, saying, well, The Cosby Show is not showing the real life of real African, regular, most African Americans. And what's fascinating is that white audience studies of whites who watch The Cosby Show, they specifically flocked to The Cosby Show. This is what they were telling researchers, because the show didn't make them confront persistent racism. It made them feel like it was true that racism had been eradicated. Now, how is all this relevant to today? I would say this, that what the 1980s was teaching us, whether on purpose or inadvertently, was that the white audience will not accept African Americans in the public sphere unless those African Americans, quote unquote, go beyond their race. They don't bring up their race. And there's an inherent bigotry in that, which is saying that America can't accept African Americans unless they basically aren't African Americans or try to run away from who they are as people. And you see this, by the way, not just with the white audience reaction to The Cosby Show. You see it with Michael Jordan in his interviews. He is very careful to say, you know, I want a white America to accept me as a person. And I want to be very clear. And of course, you see it with Barack Obama. I mean, there was this idea of the Huxtable effect, that Barack Obama was proof that we'd gone beyond race. Now, I want to be very clear. I in no way lay any blame, at least in my book, on Bill Cosby, Michael Jordan, Barack Obama for this conception. I actually think they're victims of it in this sense, that what this is really a reflection on is what the white audience demands. And the white audience since the 1980s and beyond continues to demand that African Americans and minorities in specific, but society as a whole, simply pretend that institutional racism doesn't exist, when in fact it really does exist in a very serious way.
David Sirota, our guest today on Media Matters. David, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and I'd like to ask you specifically about contemporary politics, because you constantly throughout the book bring in the contemporary situation, as you have during the show today. But so, while it's a book about the 80s, it's really a book about 2011 and going forward. And, you know, one of the interesting points you made was how our political candidates today, and I'm using my term, not yours, are more like brands. They're sort of like empty vessels that sort of really don't have policy and actual, you know, political solutions to problems really isn't even part of the issue when you vote or support candidates or when they run for office. And you mentioned both Sarah Palin and I think Barack Obama as examples of this. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's happened in our country, and I think it's really sad, is that candidates to a particular extent, but parties to an even larger extent, political parties have become, as you say, have they become brands, and you're either with them or you're against them. And what we've done is we've kind of, as a society, removed any sense of, I think, what you can call obligations to citizenship. And by citizenship, meaning that the idea that parties and politicians are vessels for our aspirations, we are not vessels for their aspirations. That we should be looking at parties and candidates as instruments of achieving what we want done, and what we want done is the most important thing, not who is doing them or which candidate we are affiliated with. And I think you can trace part of this back, I do think, to the 1980s, in the sense to that idea that we've been talking about before, about this deification of great individuals, the great man theory of history. This idea that all we have to do is get the right person, get behind the right superhuman, superman, and then we can just walk away and that person will solve all of the problems. That's the only responsibility of citizenship that we have. And what's shocking to me is that this has proven to not work so often that it's just stunning that it continues. I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, and of course there'll be people out there say, well, apparently you want the Republicans to win in 2012, which is not true, but there remains a school of thought that says you can't even ask questions about President Obama continuing major Bush-era policies that he promised to repeal because that is somehow apostasy. to the Democratic Party or to the followership of Barack Obama, when in fact it should be the other way around. The apostasy is the president who promised to do certain things, who has refused to even try to do those things.
Dan Schroeder, at that point, unfortunately, I hear the bantering up in the background. Which means they want to clear me out of the studio. And I want to thank you so much, David Schroeder, for taking time out of your schedule, away from your family on this Sunday afternoon, to join us here in Media Matters. And I hope all goes well for you.
Thanks so much, Bob.
David Schroeder, the author of Back to Our Future, our guest today. I want to thank Kyle Kroha and Melissa Trentz, my engineer and producer, respectively, for their great work. As always, I'm Bob McChesney, and I'll be back 167 hours from now. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This is WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana. It will be partly sunny today with a high near 74. East-northwest winds around 8 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 55. Tomorrow, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy with a high near 80. And Tuesday, mostly